I'd like to give you a little tour of what LHC can possibly say about quantum gravity, or at least what you can maybe extract from our data. So just to put you a little bit in context, trivial things, but it's always good to start easy a bit. What we want to do is to understand quantum gravity, things that happen, you know, at the Planck scale, quantum level, so edge bar is important, speed is important, but to describe some of those features into quantum field theory, where you essentially are not at the Planck scale, and where you can test things into colliders, quantum field theory. So to do this, you essentially embed some of the idea you have about your quantum gravity theory into an effective field theory. You complement it with some of some phenomenological models for what you cannot make any prediction, but you need to have in order to make, you know, experimental predictions. And then you do make a prediction, and you go and you test it. So this is, in a nutshell, what we are doing at the LHC. This comes from you. This comes from us. the key over here is how can we have some of the features of quantum field gravity embedded in quantum field theory that are not suppressed by super big scales. That's essentially the trick for having prediction out of it. And what I'm going to consider today is one way to do it, which is taking extra dimensions that will allow you to remove, to replace a suppression of a Planck scale to some TV scale suppression, so that you have terms in your effective theory chart that are big enough for being able to be tested. Okay? And there is two scenarios in which we can do this, or at least in which we're doing this. And this is the ADD scenario, in which you can look for direct production of gravity states. You will have some virtual KK graviton tower exchange, where the KK gravitons are tower are very close to each other. And you can have transplanking and scattering, like black holes, string balls, and what have you. So this is the ADD scenario. And the random syndrome scenario, you have warp extra dimensions, so they are much smaller. And in this case, you're essentially looking for resonances. And probably that most of you have another models, another strategy, another scenario than those one to look for quantum gravity in effective field theory. And the idea is that, yeah, fine, can still take your data despite what I'm giving you here, because we make our analysis essentially signature-based, model independent, and you can extract information out of these data anyway. Okay? Now, these ADD scenario, this random syndrome scenario that we are considering when we are looking at our data, are typically towards our very not up-to-date models, very simplistic models. And that sounds bad, because I'm betting that any of you that is looking at something in those scenarios have more complicated and sophisticated models, right? So why are we sitting and still looking at those very simple minimum models? Is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? Well, in some sense, I would say it's a bad thing. And we can see this from the fact that now more and more there is a discussion between the theory and the experimental collaborations about getting the up-to-date and sophisticated models, and us having tools to do limits on them and stuff like that. And that huge communications, which is ongoing since a couple of years, is a sign that you'd like to see constraint on or test of very sophisticated models. On the other hand, I will say not so much, because we design our analysis as much model independent as possible, and always going to provide benchmark interpretation, because it's impossible to constrain every single model that exists in the market, that some that are even not yet public, that you're probably working on it. And so it's important anyway to provide information about those simplistic benchmarks. And we're going to come back into it in a minute. But this presentation will not try to provide all the possible constraints we can have about quantum gravity. I will just refer to a small list of simple benchmarks in order to present you what are the assumptions and the condition of applicabilities of those constraints to quantum gravity benchmark. So basically, what I would like to do is to guide you through our analysis, to our data, to tell you what you can reuse and in which condition you can reuse it, such that if you can, if you want, you take our publications and you extract the information that you'd like to have, despite that this is not exactly what we're providing to you. Now, about those benchmarks, I think that the minimum ADD and random syndrome scenario, despite being very simplistic, are a very powerful benchmark. Because they are simple, they rely on a very small number of free parameters. If you compare, for example, about with the MSSM type of benchmark, where you will have a parameter face corner over here, another parameter region over here, and has very, very different kinematics, and yet we're setting this limit on this one over here, and so you cannot very use those limits. But when you have one or two parameter dependence, it is very easy to extract this information and apply it to your case, even if in your case it is more sophisticated, right? So this is one advantage of those scenarios. They are well understood also, so you know exactly what we put in there. So you are able to extract the information you need and readapt it to your case. Simulations are available to both communities. So if you have your own favorite models and you write some kind of generator out of it using MatGraph or whatever, and then you take the generator for one of those benchmarks, you run both with your set of favorite selection or whatever, and then you can use this to essentially scalar prediction or limits and then have an interpretation for your case. They often contain features that are reused in various models. You can think about the resonance. It's going to be applicable to Z-prime, excited quark, and many things like this. And therefore, it forces us to be as model-independent as possible, as I said before. And so it's a good thing for you because it means that our data for which we set limits on it will have some useful for you, even if we're not testing your model. And anyway, often the theoretical difference are very important between models, but the financial difference are not that big. You know, when you look at the jets or missing transverse energy on what I view, this is kind of more inclusive type of, you know, observables. And so despite that your two different, your models might be very different than the benchmark in the theoretical aspect, experimentally speaking, you can probably have something which is quite similar and therefore reuse again the information to constrain your models. And I would say there is another point which is important more for us than for you, but having simple benchmark allows us to compare our analysis, to compare our experiment, to say your experiment is worse than mine, my analysis is better than yours, because we can compare those simple benchmarks and see, ah, we're setting better limits, so we win, woo! And this is a good way to test how we are performing, how we are evolving our analysis, how our tools are developing, and stuff like that. So it's a good indicator for us. So we can take two approaches when we're doing this, when we're trying to set limits on models and stuff like that. The first one is to essentially go through the different models themselves. And in a given models, you will have different final state that will give you a test of that models, right? And it's important for us to test all of those final state, despite there is one which is better than all the other one, because you might have a more sophisticated model for which you have one of the final states that doesn't exist. So for example, suppose you have some kind of Z-prime models that are leptophobic, and then we were setting limit just on Z-prime in mu mu channel because this was the best, then you will not be able to use our data in any out because you don't have any Z-prime to E coupling in this case. So despite the fact that we have, despite the fact that there is some final state that are more sensitive than some others, we set limits on all of them in order to provide maximum information to the theory community. On the other side, one final state can be sensitive to various models, and we keep this in mind. In our paper, we set limits on all those various models that are sensitive to this final state physics, because that forces us to be model independent and therefore to be able to provide some interpretation of our data that could possibly be reused by you. In this presentation, I choose to present things in order of models because our paper are presented in order of final states, and therefore you will have both complementary pictures. So I'm going to discuss first about direct prediction of gravity with monojets and monophoton analysis, virtual KK tower graviton exchange with non-resident leptons and diphoton analysis, black hole and strict ball with high mass multi-object and same sign dimuon, random syndrome scenario with resonance and diphoton and dileptin, And finally, I'm going to show you how to, because we set some model-independent limits on resonance and digest and gamma plus jets, and I'm going to show you how you can reuse this directly in your analysis, in your, in, you know, for concerning your theory, if you have such signature. Few words about DLHC, about ATLAS. I won't go into a typical explanation of how fantastic your detector is and how DLHC is working and cool machine it is, because you saw this many times before. But what I want to say is, A, we took a lot of data so far, 500 femtobound of data last year. We have 17, actually, at ATV, and we're still taking data until the end of the year. So it's going very, it is going very, very well. 17 femtobound of data, it's a lot of data. And it allows us to do very good stuff with our, you know, data analysis. First of all, we found the Higgs, and I have to put quote unquote because yes, we don't know what it is. Yes, it might be not the Higgs, and you're still probably dreaming about what it could be. Nevertheless, we find something, and something which is not easy to find. Okay, so that tells us that we're doing a very good job at understanding our data. Also, we did our duty, we did our assignment. We went and measured the standard candlestick, the standard model cross-section with very high precision, and we've been probing NLO and even NNLO calculations and having good agreement for W production, cross-section of the Z, TT bar, single top, dye boson, and so on and so forth. And the fact that we have all those agreements tell us we understand what we're doing. And so it's good for you, because if we constrain something, we constrain it with, you know, good knowledge of the data, and if we find a deviation, give us confidence that it might be something important. So let's jump into the interpretation we can give to our data. I won't go too much in details about the model assumption because you know them very, very well. I want to see here that for the random sundrum scenario, essentially you have small extra dimensions that allow you to nevertheless have some scale of the new physics, which is at the TV scales. And the fact that these extra dimensions are not very big means that there is some separation between the different Kaluza-Klein mode, which is large, 1 TV or something like that. So typically when we test those models, what we are doing is looking for resonances that are at the TV level. Okay, so this is what we essentially mean by random sundrum. And our experimental point of view. Resonance is very general. We look at this through various channels. The first one we look at is a diphoton resonance. This is very important because this is a clean signature, has low background, very good mass resolution because we have a fantastic electromagnetic calorimeter that allows us to find the Higgs. And if you go more in terms of models interpretation, the branching fraction of graviton to two photon is twice higher than what you will have for a graviton goes to a pair of leptons. That's essentially model independent because it just relies on democratic couplings of gravity to normal matter. And we don't have spin one resonance that gives you final state of two photon, at least in general quantum mechanics. Probably you can violate this in some sense. But that's in a way something which is interesting because you cannot have a Z that couples to a pair of gamma. And so that's kind of, you know, pointing toward gravity, right? In terms of analysis, the gamma, as I see, are rather well understood. So we can essentially use Monte Carlo to produce the, to make predictions for the main irreducible background, I would say. Nevertheless, when you're talking about fake background, a fake background is when you have a QCD jet, which is mimicking the signature of a gamma. Then you need, you cannot rely on Monte Carlo for this. Essentially, the cross-section for QCD is very, very high. The probability of faking a photon is very, very low. So somehow you can see it's the cancellation of two big numbers, and this is something which is never really well understood. So what we have to do is to use data to make those predictions and make some kind of extrapolation to signal region. And here you see an example of a diphoton event where you see the two photon tower and the calorimeter over here. And what you can see is that an electromagnetic calorimeter, you have segmentation that allow you to make direction reconstruction, which is new and very important. Now, what you do is that, from what I said before, you get your background estimate, which is essentially this line over here. And then you take your data that are the point over here. And since we're looking for resonance, you run a bump hunter algorithm. In this case, we run it in a signal region that covers 400 GeV to 3 TeV. And we keep the region below that to essentially control our normalization for the background, because we know there is nothing in there. And the bell bumping algorithm, what it's looking is that, what it is doing is that it is looking for the most significant deviation you can find with respect to the null hypothesis, to the background only hypothesis, by using windows of mask that goes from two bins to n over two bins and scanning. So you start here, two bins, scan, 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 three bins, scan, 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 blah, 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 until you have a huge bin like this that you scan through the region over here. And you're looking for the most important deviation with respect to your standard model predictions. The algorithm takes into account the look-elsewhere effect, which means that if you're making, this is not, when you look at many bins, you're essentially doing many experiments. And when you do many experiments, you have a chance to have deviations. So we have to take this into account. Okay? So it does. Now, from this analysis, the biggest deviation came in the bin, which is between 1.3 TeV and 1.6 TeV, sorry, in the inverted mass of the gamma. Nevertheless, there is 86% of the chance that a larger excess come from background fluctuation only. That tells you there is no bump in that in those data. No discovery, therefore constrained. So we set constraint on the Randall-Sundrum scenario, as I said before. So essentially, a constraint on the mass of the graviton for various values of the couplings. The where plots are set, and you're going to see this many, many, many times, so I'm going to spend time to explain this one. You will see in that line what is our model-independent interpretation limits, I meant, expected limits on signal time cross-section, time acceptance for data. To tell you how much new physics event are tolerable within uncertainties in our data. The green and the yellow bands are uncertainty, 1 sigma the uncertainty, and the green 2 sigma with the yellow. And then you compare with the data and you get the red. The red is the observed limit. So when the red is above the dot line, you have a little excess. When it is below, you have a little deficit. And because it is inside the uncertainty band, it means there is nothing significant out there. Then once you have this, and this is what I say model independent, okay? Then you essentially take your favorite models, you compute the acceptance into this, and you compute the cross-sections, and you make, for various hypotheses of your models, the cross-section dependence in terms of the mass of your particles. It could be the mass in this case, if it's another type of models, it's going to be another parameters, but whatever it's your parameters, you get your cross-section and function of it, and the intersection between the red and that line tell you the constraint that you have. So here we have a constraint for various values of the couplings for the mass of the graviton. What we can do is that just plot this into a 2D plot where you have the two unknown parameters and you have essentially how much the limit on the graviton mass is as a function of the couplings. And you can see that roughly it goes from 1 TeV to 2 TeV for a coupling of 0.01 to 2.1 in value.
Excuse me, yeah. What is the value of Planck mass here?
Oh, that's a 10 to the 19 GeV, right?
Okay, so that's the standard one.
So they are related at this point, right? So this is 1 TeV, and that's, yeah. So each time you see PL, PL is the standard 10 to the 19 GeV. I have to say that over here, we apply K factor of 1.75 to take into account QCD corrections. That's, I know. Not necessarily needed, but we did it. Anyway. Then we can play the same game with dilaton final state, electron and muon. Can do it separately. You can combine at the end of the day. And in this case, we don't care about charge because we don't want to mess with systematics uncertainty due to charge misID. Simplify the analysis a little bit. We can predict Drellian with Monte Carlo because we have n NLO calculation for this in function of the inverted mass. We need, of course, to estimate the fake background, so the probability that QCD fake a pair of electrons. This is possible. We have to use data for this. And the point is that we normalize the full background that we have under the Z peak. And that allows us to essentially kill a lot of systematics uncertainty. You're essentially just sensitive on the spread of those uncertainty as you go at higher and higher mass. And they are nevertheless small because the dominant uncertainty comes from the theory assumption that you put in your background estimate. Essentially. And as you can see, in both the plot or on the table for various regions, the data are in good agreement with the predictions, and therefore, once again, you can't see new physics in there. Nevertheless, we can set constraints on models. And again, Randall syndrome scenario gives you one example of interpretation you can do. And in this case, you will see that an acceptance is typically of 70% for electron and 45% for a muon. And this is independent of the mass of your graviton. So if you have a resonance, whatever it is, that will couple to a pair of electron or muons, then you can take those numbers for acceptance and just go and get constraint on your model. In this scenario, we haven't applied K factors to set limits, so it's not exactly clear how you can compare them. They are typically a bit lower than what you will have if you put K factors, of course. But the point is that you do exactly the same things. You constrain your graviton mass in function of the couplings that you have. For various couplings, you can have various mass. So this is another way to present the 2D plot I have in the previous slides. And we can see that with this combined electron and muon channel, we can reach essentially 2.5 TeV, which shows you the scales of exclusion we have. And we have now 8 TeV data. We have 6 inverse femtobound of TeV data analyzed already. So the same about same size of the data sets. And the point is that when you have higher cross sections, higher energy in the center of mass, you have higher cross sections for your models. And therefore, you have tighter limits. And in this case, I don't have yet a Randall syndrome interpretation, but I have a Z prime interpretation. And what I did is to put side by side the 7 TeV Z prime and the 8 TeV Z prime to show you a bit what is the impact of the extension. And you essentially can get a couple of 100 of GeV on the limit simply just because you increase the center of mass from 7 to 8. Now, if you go to 14 TeV, the increase is much bigger, again, because it is an exponential increase. And therefore, we're going to increase a lot the sensitivity and increase the mass scales of new physics we can probe after the shutdown in a couple of, 2 years maybe. So this is it for resonance search interpreted in the random scenario. Random scenario. Syndrome. Right. Well, ADD scenario, the other type of interpretation. What is the huge difference between these two scenarios? Here, the extra dimensions are big. And so the spacing between Kaluza-Klein mode is small, so that you have somehow like a continuous mass graviton which is produced rather than a very high massive graviton which is produced. So basically, the huge difference is that you cannot look for resonance in this case. So you have to look at other tricks. But what you can do is that you can look at direct production of graviton in the final state, accompanied by some activities. For example, it could be a jet. Now I say monojet, but in fact you have some extra jets due to QCD radiation. So we can talk about jet plus missing entity, but one which is dominant, of course. Or you can have this as being a photon, and then you look at monophoton analysis. There is a difference between the two scenarios in that you will not have quark gluon or gluon-gluon process that's going to give you the photon final state. So the dependence on the cross-section for the signal will be different for monojet than for monophoton. And you will see that this impacts how much the limit changes with the number of extra dimension, which is one of the parameters of the theory. So let's start first with the monojet analysis. You can see over here the tower of one jet in the calorimeter. You can see essentially here where the missing ET is pointing. And this analysis is very interesting because it used fully data-driven method to estimate the background. And that allowed to make prediction in some kinematic region for the standard model contribution at the 3.2% level. So, thank you. So think about it, 3% predictions on jet plus ET miss. This is fantastic precision, which allow you to A, test, increase the sensitivity to your to your new physics, because you have smaller uncertainties, so there is more place for having new physics event in your data. But also it tells you how much robust your prediction is, so if we see deviations, you can believe it, because we understand things very, very well. Of course, so what we did is that we separated the signal region in 4 different regions that allow you to essentially pick up the one which is the most satisfying for your models. Maybe for ADD, we set limits in the biggest kinematic region, but maybe for some kind of dark matter scenario where you have a pair of quark and anti-quark that collide and give you a pair of dark matters, and the jets would be just like from initial state radiation, the jets will be softer and the signal region one will be probably better in this case, right? So that by separating your kinematic region like this, it's allow you to pick up the one which is the most advantageous to you and leave us some kind of model independence. Now, repeating the analysis and these of those kinematic regions, in all the cases, you see a very, very good middle one sigma agreement between data and predictions. And again, no excess have been made, and we can set limits. So the first thing to do is to compute acceptance for your model. And the acceptance that we obtain for JET and MET selections is 83% for the AD scenario. Now, if we run just the event selection into Z to nu plus JETs processes, or dark matter model or stuff like, or similar model like this, we also get something between 80 and 85%. So that tells you that this acceptance value is more or less model independent. And then if you have some model that have a JET plus missing ET as a final state, which is not EDD, nevertheless, you can use this to essentially see how much your data is constraining your models before, but without having us to write a full Monte Carlo running through the full simulations and what have you. We set limits at 95% confidence levels on the Planck mass. So here you see in dashed black line the expected limits on our data that are model dependent, how much event are possible into our data that are not coming from new physics. The red line is the actual observed limit, and the band that you see over here are the different models cross-section times acceptance and function of the Planck scale, and the width of this band is the uncertainty on those models. This allows us to get constraint on the Planck scale for various number of extra dimensions, and you see it drop from essentially 4.2 TeV to essentially 2.5, 2.6 TeV at n equals 6. There is one caveat I have to mention over here, is that this being minimalistic models, with a Planck scale which is below the center of mass energy we can reach at the TeV, it means that we have an effective theory that must be valid below the Planck scale, and therefore we are probing UV region where the calculation is no more valid. What we did, just to try to quantify this a bit and weave you with way, but anyway to give you some ideas, is to see how much the prediction is sensitive on the UV sector by essentially cutting off the phase space where you will have event produced higher than the Planck scale. And by looking at how the cross-section varies when you take all the center of mass energy possibles and those that are truncated to the Planck scale. And you see that for n equal to extra dimension, you essentially have no deviations. Therefore, this limit is robust enough despite the calculation is not valid close to the Planck scale. However, when you go to the n equals 6 region over here, you see that the 60% deviations will be expected from this effect. So that's, so the 60% has to be, it's not a clear number telling you what is the uncertainty of your models, but it certainly tells you that you are UV sensitive, and so the limit has to be taken with a pinch of salt. But we do have set limits on SR1, the single region 1, 2, and 3, which has lower kinematic. And in this case, despite the limits are slightly worse, they are less UV sensitive. So if you want to have something more robust, you can take those lower kinematic regions, see what the limits are, and then have something which is less UV sensitive. So we provide all those numbers in our papers. Now, monophoton, we can do the exact same thing, except that we don't have a JET, we have a photon, which is, as I said twice already, more easily understandable than JETs. And so in this analysis, we haven't done sophisticated data-driven estimate because the systematics are rather well under control by just taking Monte Carlo. Of course, because we're using Monte Carlo, they are nevertheless not as precise as the monojet one, but this is nevertheless good enough for setting limits in those scenarios. This is the ETMIS distribution as you see it from data and from prediction, and this is what models will give you if it was overlying the actual data we have. So again, there is a good agreement between our data and our prediction within uncertainties, and we can set limits on the EDT scenario. In this case, we have an acceptance time efficiency, which is about 20%, independent on the Planck scale and the number of extra dimensions. So again, a quite robust number that you can reuse despite the fact that you will not necessarily look at EDT scenario. In fact, if we look at some other scenario like dark matter production, you will have a variation between 18 and 23%. So a very small bracket of acceptance, which is essentially good for very, very, very different models. Now we set limits again on the cross section times acceptance and efficiency at 6.8 femtobound minus one. Femtobound, not minus one. And we use an LO correction, again QCD correction, to normalize the cross sections for the model. And you can see that you have essentially no dependence on the size, on the number of extra dimensions, and contrary to what you have in the monojet analysis. Now, what happened in the monojet analysis, because you have two other processes, the limits are enhanced in that region. So they are weaker, of course, in the monophoton one, smaller cross-section, also less sensitivity. Nevertheless, it is completely independent in the other analysis, and maybe your models don't have any monojet, but have this one, and so you have the information. I won't go into details, too much into details here, but I wanted just to say that the cool interpretation of the monojet analysis is to provide limits on dark matter candidate. This is not quantum gravity, but it's still cosmology. And what I would like to focus on is that we can convert our limits on the, so essentially we're sensitive to annihilation of quark anti-quark producing a pair of dark matter particles. But we can convert this into a direct detection cross sections with spin independent or spin dependent limits. And you can see that in the spin independent scenario, we are a bit not as good as xenon 100, but above below 12 GV for WIMPs, we are doing much better, and we can exclude this better than any direct detection experiment made. And when we take the spin dependent case, then we are doing better than any other experiment in constraining it. So the LHC is saying cool stuff about direct dark matter, dark matter detections, and complementary to what direct dark matter searches is telling you. Now, still in the ADD scenario, but talking this time about virtual graviton, what we like to do over here is to see how much we could set constraint models by looking at the impact of having a spin two particles in the virtual propagator between the final state and the initial state. Now, the effective Lagrangian that you have when you do this is completely model dependent, UV dependent, and what have you. Nevertheless, we expect to see phenomenological difference because you have this dimension 8 operator that has contribution, spin, that give a spin two contribution to the scattering predictions. And so we can see if we can expect some deviation in this kind of scenario. The limit has to be taken with a pinch of salt, of course, but what are we doing is that, and I'm going to show you that, this is the same thing as just looking for compositeness and directly apply the compositeness limits to this kind of ADD scenario model, okay? And so basically, what you do is that in the contact interactions, you have the possibility of an interference between your contact interaction terms and your Drellian, and the possibility of a pure contact interaction. They are suppressed by a scale of 1 over lambda square or 1 over lambda 4, and the interaction could be destructive, the interference could be destructive or constructive with your Drellian process. And this is how we are testing the contact interaction models. Now, for this virtual graviton case, you simply convert this interference terms as 1 over ms square when ms is the string scale, or 1 over ms 8 where these factors correspond to a graviton only term in your calculations. And you will have unresolved mass spectrum for various KK modes. So essentially, you're looking for deviation in high invariant mass distribution rather than a bump in invariant mass distribution. Okay? So for contact interaction, you can see over here the cumulative distribution of the invariant distribution. Prediction is in gray. Data is in black, very, very close to the prediction. And you see the effect of the various model hypotheses as we would see it if it was there. Again, we normalize the data under the ZP to control systematics and what have you. And obviously, we have no deviation, so we can set limits on the contact interaction scale, lambda, with two hypotheses, the lambda square hypothesis or the lambda 4 hypothesis, and with two cases, the constructive interference and the destructive interference. And you can see that the limits essentially goes between 7 TeV and 10 TeV, right? And so, despite that, we don't have yet limits on the ADD scenario for this. It's just a question of converting numbers to have limits on this. So you can do the same thing at home if you want. Now, for the Diophantine final state, the same analysis as I presented earlier with the random sample scenario, we use it to set limits on this virtual graviton propagation. But rather than looking for a bump on thing, we look just for deviation in the high mass range. And we see that the best signal region is about 1.2 TeV for a mass of 2.5 TeV for the Randall-Sundrum scenario. And we set limits. So essentially, this is our model independent limits, as I said before. This is the, all the cross section varies with the, what you have it over here is essentially just this factor over here. And what you can see is that for all the points for which the data are below the cross-section line, this is excluded and this is excluded. And since eta is 1 over ms squared, you can set limits therefore on ms squared for the hypothesis of constructive or destructive interference. And these are the limits that you see over here in these tables. And why you have GRWE with HLZ is because you can have various definitions for this one over here. The Giudice Rattazzi and Wells convention is to take 1. UWIT is to take n minus 2 over pi or something like that. And I don't remember what is this convention, but it's again just a scaling factor that you apply. And so that covered this topic. Now let's move to Trans-Planckian scenario. The idea over here is that if the impact parameter between the two quarks colliding into a collision is smaller than the Schwarzschild radius, you can form black holes. Yes, no dangerous one, because those black holes will radiate, will give energy, and this is very important. This is how we can see them, right? There is many different type of models. I think that Xavier will talk about this, but anyway, there is non-rotating black holes, rotating black holes, and all this impact the spectrum of the particles emitted at the when the black hole evaporate. Of course, when the black hole evaporates, it loses energy, its mass goes down toward the Planck scale. We don't know what is going on at the Planck scale. This is the point of that workshop. So we have to have some kind of theoretical models of what is going on out there. Based on extrapolations from what is happening in the semi-classical regime, we expect that you have a smaller number of particles that get emitted, and then you embed this into your model scenario, and then you look for predictions. Now, you can do similar stuff by looking at some kind of string balls models. I think Doug, we're going to talk about this, so I don't want to insist on this, but the point is that we have very model-dependent spectrum and multiplicity for final state and for particles in the final state. But if you're clever enough by choosing well your observables, you can set models in such a way that they are limits in such a way that they are not model dependent, right? So basically, you expect to have either a lot of particles in the final state or not so much particles in the final state. Despite all the very complicated way you can put this in the models, experimentally speaking, a lot and not a lot is easy to test, so you can test for one, test for the other one. And also you can rely on the fact that they have a universal coupling to gravity to essentially count the number of degrees of freedom at which you can decay. And you say, okay, I'm expected in the high multiplicity to have some latent in the final states, and you're gonna have many jets, of course. So if I'm looking at an analysis for which I have just many objects, and one of which is IPT lepton, then I will have something which is good enough to kill my, to suppress my background, my standard model background, and keep very high sensitivity to my model, okay, regardless of what it is. So we did two search for this. The first one focused on the object that you can reconstruct and say, okay, let's count how many objects I have in my event. A jet is an object, a tau is an object, a photon is an object, and so on and so forth. Make sure they are quite energetic, so the sum of the energy, transverse energy of those jets is big, 1.5 TeV. And just look for deviation. And the impact of just doing this kind of simple approach is that it mitigates the effect of large remnant uncertainty. So basically it removes a large fraction of the model independence. And then that is what the observable would look like. A sum of the transverse energy of all the objects in the event. You can see the steeply falling spectrum of standard models, and you can see what our models of of black holes will give you, striking signature, if the hypotheses are correct. By looking at the total background compared to the data and various schematic regions, we can see good agreement again and be ready to set limits into this. We have generators, the risk calculations, to get the specifics of the models, the calculation, but also the phenomenological models about how the black holes is decaying at the end. And this is the list of hypotheses that we're setting in those calculations. You will see that one of the calculations made from the Caribdas generator is looking at both low multiplicity and high multiplicity black holes, while black mass is concentrating on the high multiplicity. But the good news is that the two generators give you concordant predictions on similar regimes. So we can go look at the comparison between data and Monte Carlo for the predictions and set 95 confidence limit level limits on the cross-sections for a black hole scenario. And you see how much this cross-section evolve when you, the limits evolve when you crank the kinematic region. So that tells you that higher, tighter kinematic cut allow you to probe more and more the physics or set tighter and tighter limits. The limits are at the 16.7 femtobound level at this point. And the acceptance efficiency varies between essentially 60% in the electron channels and 45% in the muon channels. This is the signal efficiency, so this is the detector effect, and these are numbers that you can essentially reuse. Now, the probability of emitting an IPT lepton is Malone dependent, but it is essentially going between 10 and 50%, which is still not a big bracket given the order of magnitude we're talking when we're talking about black hole effect. So now we set limits on black holes. This is essentially threshold on the mass of the black holes, and in function of the Planck scale, because the black hole has to be higher than the Planck scale. So when you have an intersection between the fraction, the factor of time the black hole mass is higher than the Planck scale, you can see what are the limits for various values of the Planck scale. In this case, you have a high multiplicity limit and a low multiplicity limit, one by black max generator, one from Caribdas generator. And what you can see is that the limits are quite comparable to each other, a little bit lower in the low multiplicity because you have a lower chance to emit this IPT photon you're selecting. And then you can do the thing with string balls, and then you will have rotating, non-rotating black holes and rotating string balls, sorry, models. Again, the limits are lower for the rotating and for the non-rotating one, because when you rotate, you emit less particles, and they are smaller than for the high multiplicity one because the string ball has less smaller multiplicity. But basically, that tells you that you have the same procedure, the same data analysis that can be used in many various scenarios to set comparable limits. Now we test another hypothesis, another approach for the analysis, and it is that rather than looking at reconstructed objects, so a jet contains many track into it, right? So we say rather than just counting the number of jets that you have and asking to have at least three in your events and what have you, we just count the number of track, and we can look for two muons in the final state. And we can look for two sensei muons, so that suppresses the background a lot and allow you to make some predictions that are very robust and quite independent and orthogonal to the previous analysis I showed you. This is what the track multiplicity will look like from standard models, prediction versus observation. And this is what we would expect from black holes type of scenario. And again, you see a very good agreement between data and observations. And you can use this to set constraint in the exact same way I did in the previous slide. And in this case, I use comparison between non-rotating and rotating black holes. And we also look at what happens if you take various number of extra dimension scenario. Of course, when you increase the number of extra dimension, you increase the Planck scale. If you increase the Planck scale, there is less place in our energy, in our collider, for having a massive black hole, so the limits are lower. But that tells you that you are doing essentially the same game as what we do with the other analysis and have comparable limits. They are a bit weaker in this case, but nevertheless, it is a good orthogonal cross-check of this. So this is for black holes, and now I just want to come back to resonance to say that I set limits on random sundrum scenario, but you can have your favorite models that has a resonance which is not random sundrum. For example, the Rege excitations of string theory predicts gamma jets and diejet resonances. And so what can we do with this? Well, we don't have quantum gravity models. We don't have these limits for these models over here. But we did a model-independent search for resonance, assuming a Gaussian peak. Like maybe your resonance will not be Gaussian, but this is nevertheless a good way to make a model-independent set of limits that you can directly reuse. And I'm going to tell you how you can reuse them for your own model. So the idea of the analysis strategy is a bit like what we did for the diphoton resonance search. So you apply some selections, you reconstruct the invariant mass, you smooth your background predictions, and then you run a bomb hunter algorithm and you set limits, right? So this is the same thing of what we did. Now, what the limits looks like? Well, they look like a limit on the cross-section time acceptance in function of the mass of your Gaussian peak for various width of the Gaussian peak that you take in the digest analysis and in the gamma blur plus jets analysis. And I have to say that these ones are 8 TV data, so they're very, very fresh result. And the limits are again similar than what you will obtain in a diphoton analysis, except they are fully, fully model independent. And how could you reuse this? Well, this is a recipe that you can use. You make your calculations, and you ask your best friend, or you do it yourself, and write a little generator. Maybe you add that into MatGraph or whatever, and you generate a little Monte Carlo samples at a mass m that you choose. This is your mass that you're testing. Then you apply the selection cuts that we have in our analysis that are quite simple, and you smear the invariant mass distribution that you obtain from this with our detector resolution. Now, you don't know what they are, but for 1 TeV to 5 TeV, the resolution goes from 5 to 4%. So you can essentially just do a Gaussian smearing of the invariant mass distribution with a width of 5 or 4%, depending on where your resonance is, and you are good. Then you need to suppress the tail of the reconstruction mass distribution because we are in the Gaussian hypothesis. So basically, you can take the mass of your invariant mass distribution between 0.8 and 1.2 of the mass that you put in your calculation. You compute your acceptance, so the number of events before your cut divided by the number of events after your cut, just the opposite of that, sorry. And you have a number, and you take your tables, and you see what is the limits for that number, right? That is a number on sigma times acceptance. You just compute the acceptance. You know you're on cross-section, so you know what it will be. You look for a value of mg, for a value of your mass that corresponds to the Gaussian mass that we have in our tables. And you can use, this is an empirical rule, it's not a rule, like an empirical guiding idea of which resolution you can take, 1.2 times the mass minus 0.8 times the mass divided by 5. But we saw that the limits are not super dependent on the width anyway. So by doing this, you will be able to constrain your models for that mass. And then what you can do is that you generate these samples for various mass, and when you will see an equality between this and this, and the limits, you see, here we go, this is the mass limits on my resonance, my favorite resonance, regardless of what it is. Okay? So a recipe which is very useful, despite the fact that we're setting limits on a simple model. So to conclude, quantum gravity feature can be predicted, well, embedded into effective field theory, and therefore tested at the LHC. In the case of assuming extra dimensions, we can look for direct graviton production, virtual graviton transfer, Trans-Pelagian states. But you can look for other things as well, because essentially what we did is that we look at many resonances, monojets, monophoton, and multi objects final state in a model independent, and essentially give you all the idea, all the element, the tools that you can use to essentially know what we put in our limits, and therefore use this to extrapolate to your scenario, to your favorite scenario. And we give even some model independence limits to simplify your job in doing so. So despite the fact we are using simple models, they are good for you to adapt to your scenario. And you know, I covered just a little part of all the limits we are doing over here. Yesterday, we saw, for example, a presentation where we were setting limits on quantum gravity by looking at the shape of a jet or the acoplanarity of a multi-jet event, which is not in this class, but it is on some other class. So basically, because we did a similar strategy, maybe your models look like more an excited muon analysis, and you can already see an idea of what will be the exclusion scales for this. So this is a generic summarized plot of all the limits we have in Atlas. We have this in our public page, so you are welcome to take a look into this. And just before concluding, I would like to do like my other experimental colleagues did in the previous days, to thank all the people that work very, very hard to get those results. Thank you.
Questions?
Curious about your chapter on black holes. You mentioned various scenarios on the cold remnants as the final state of black holes. Now, as in public safety, we had a little model where with all sorts of hand waving, we could predict that a remnant is formed. But my question is, would you be able to tell from the data, assuming those black hole exists, whether or not this remnant forms or doesn't form? In case it doesn't form, it would sort of be this catastrophic event, one loop calculations or the entropy ideas would predict.
Right, so one of the, to give a first a general answer to your question, is that one of the drawback of setting the analysis in such a way that they are more or less model independent is that you're not sensitive to very small features. So what can we do with those limits so far? We can look at, you know, I'm misplicity versus low misplicity, and if a model of remnant will give you rather low misplicity, maybe we can say something in this. But to disentangle the various models at this point, I don't think we can do it with those analyses. Of course, if we have a signal, we'll try to be more clever. You'll try to be more clever. We can, and then we'll try to measure different things. But I don't think we can make a distinction if we had a signal today with this about what will be the remnant models, despite the fact, except the fact that maybe in one model you have different multiplicities. Now, maybe in your scenario, will tell us, right, now I have some kind of calculation. Well, the point is that you don't have calculation, right? So you'd like to have input for doing this.
No, but if the remnant would not form nicely, one would expect some sort of real catastrophe according to what people usually say about the final.
I mean, a catastrophe like the people that are suing CERN and stuff like that?
No, okay. No, a catastrophe for one loop or semi-classic.
Oh, yeah, for the calculation and stuff like that. Yeah, so yeah, it would be very hard to tell.
Sorry for that.
No, no.
I think I can say your question. We're looking at these kind of things with the collaborators. Typically, your remnant would have to be charged of being fractional because it's created from quarks. Now, what matters is how fast the remnant moves. And if it moves slowly, which can happen if it has a lot of high mass, it will be typically fairly slow, they may not see it because the trigger time is 25 nanoseconds. So you may have a shot to see fast remnant because it'll do funny things in the detector. If they're slow, you have to go to MUEDAL, which is another experiment, and another type of detector that, from what I understand, can see slower moving particles that have fractional charges.
But they will decay later, right?
If they're remnant, no.
Not at all?
No.
Okay.
So it all depends on how fast they move in the detector and how you can, that tells you how you can see them.
Other questions? So can you give us an idea with 14 TeV energy and with better and better statistics, what will be the Planck scale that you can reach, for example, on ADD models? How far will you go?
Yes. So this is based on simulations, old simulations, not complete, good detector, and stuff like that. We could reach essentially square root of, we could reach essentially square root of S. We can reach 13, 14 TeV.
Okay, but you can't go higher because of the large background.
Right, as I said, you know, it depends, you know, at this point, 14, 13, 16, you know, we have to redo the right analysis, right? But that tells you that roughly, you know, a scale is the center of mass energy. And that was considering 100 inverse femtobound. So huge amount of data, right? This is 5, right? But the point is that by going from 7 TV to 14 TV, you gain crazy a lot. And then statistics will rise and stuff, of course.
Okay, more questions? If not, then I think it's time for the coffee break. And for everyone who didn't get the conference photo yesterday, I put a few here. And please check at 20 past 7.